Hello, this is Black Country Blokes chewing the fat.
Listen.
I've been hearing a lot lately about men don't talk, but in my experience, men do talk, just people aren't listening. So it's going to be me and a group of blokes discussing our struggles and victories through life. Warning, there may be some bad language, so apologies to all the moms, especially my own. Let's get going.
Listen.
Having you guys is the Black Country Blokes chewing the fat about everything that is mental health, disability and life in general. Here with me, Kev Dillon, and my partner in crime, as always, Lee Cadman. And we're joined by a very good mate of mine, Aid.
Cutler.
Very good mate, but I don't know your second name.
I told you, terrible with the last names. At least you got your first name right.
You did, dude.
And we're going to be getting into Aid's life and everything in a bit. But as always, our gratitude list. And as always, I've got a lot to be grateful for. I mean, something as have to do with my wife going through some stuff. You know, we just need a laptop for whatever reason. And panicking, we couldn't get one. And then Super Pal over here just helped set something up for us. And it's something like that, you know, it's something soft. But it makes a big difference because when my wife's different to me, I like to think logically. And it's like, something's broke. We haven't got one. Who can help? And I always think that. Ask for help of friends, and if you've got a good friend, if they can help you, they can't help you. But instead of just thinking all is doomed, thinking, okay, to step out the situation, what can we do about it? Whose computer can we use? Who can give us advice? And I asked, and you helped us in your pub.
I did, mate. I did.
So just something soft, but something to be grateful for. What are you grateful for, old pal?
Oh, my wife surprised me on Thursday evening for my 40 this week. Sunday. Just dig it out. So she surprised me with a trip to Liverpool the weekend just gone. So yeah, I'm just grateful for that. We had a fantastic time. Really great. Just an overnight stay. Break from the kids. Yeah, it's just nice. Nice meal.
But the first time you two have done something like that in forever, isn't it?
Yeah, we don't do it very often. It's hard to find babysitters for the little one. So yeah, it was nice just to get away and be a couple for a change instead of mom and dad.
And I think every relationship needs that, doesn't it? Sometimes
absolutely.
It's
a bit of space.
And it's just being, as you say, husband and wife, boyfriend and girlfriend, whatever the circumstances, or just we're us. We haven't always got to be mommy and daddy. Mm. We can be human beings.
That's
you know?
Exactly.
I
agree.
That's it.
And we all like to feel like we're going, we won't get out of bed, but the only way we're getting out of bed is because we're asleep.
Well, you know what, Kev, as well, I've been around Liverpool countless times for work, but never really stopped there. It's always driving in or to someone's house. And Liverpool's absolutely beautiful city, and there's a lot to do there. Yeah,
and
it's really nice.
The skates are great, isn't they?
Yeah. So, grateful for that.
And what are you grateful for, Aid?
What am I grateful for? Grateful for my family. Mm. I think one of the things we were just talking about before we came on air about reconnecting with my family over lockdown and rebuilding some of the relationships that are potentially damaged by kind of how I was over the course of the few years before then. And the fact that as they're growing up, you know, my lad's now 16, my eldest daughter's 17, my youngest 13. It's just a different relationship to what it was when I was, I think I said earlier on, I missed out a lot on their younger childhood when I was working as hard as I was. So now they're becoming sort of less grumpy, reactive teenagers. And I'm probably less grumpy, reactive dad as I was in the past. Mm. As they're more maturing and I'm probably being less immature. We're probably coming together a bit more. So we've got some really great relationships developing and growing. So that's, that keeps me happy.
In infant love, being parent, you can see your children in you. You see your good qualities. We also see bad qualities, don't you? And like stuff like that. And like sometimes when you find yourself more snappy and more snarky with them, they're more snarky with you, and you're thinking, well, you've picked that up from somewhere, and it's looking a lot like how I am.
Yeah.
And I've had that sometimes, and it's not what you say to a child, it's how you say it. And sometimes you're thinking,
your actions.
Your actions, or the huff and they puff and they slam, or and you're thinking, oh my God, I can see myself and I don't like that.
Blame your wife.
They say that the kids are a product of their parents, aren't they? And how you parent them in their early stages is how they live their lives. Mm. I sometimes look at my kids and go, oh, Christ, I did that. Yeah. That's terrible. I made them like that. But by and large, they're good kids, so I can't complain. That's all from their mum, obviously.
That's the beautiful look. We had the girls on the other week talking about might be something you want to be involved in as well, because we're giving over the next 12 months getting blokes, dads, because there's many different shades of being a dad. In and there's the biological dad, the stepdad, the foster dad, the disabled dad, the dad of a disabled child, all these different things. But getting dads to talk about being a dad. Mm. And I think that we feel like I failed, I've worked too much, I didn't work enough, I did this. I think the important thing is love and being there, being consistent for them. And I was talking to a guy the other day saying, I feel guilty because I went, every parent, man and woman, feel guilty with parents. There's certain things 100%. That we do. But we do it. Everything we do at that time is for the right reason. Mm. It's only later when you go, oh, I dropped a bollock there.
But you can always look back and say, well, I could have done something different. I should have done something differently there. I could have worked less. I could have worked more. It doesn't matter. You can't revise history, can you? You can always look back on it and say, well, I could have done something different. Mm. Different might not be better. Mm. I might have said to the kids, instead of working all that hours, God sends and not seeing you, I'll be home at 3 o'clock every day and we won't go on holiday. And they might have hated that.
Mm.
They might have hated having me around, to be fair.
Mm.
But, you know, so I think you've got to look forward, not backwards, haven't you?
And I think the problem is we're looking backwards. And I used to do this a lot better with my eyes. And you go, like, wait. If I hadn't lost my eyesight, or if my dad had stayed home, or dad, you do all these things, but you're living in a universe that doesn't exist.
Yeah,
it has happened like this.
Yeah.
This is the universe that is. Play those cards. Don't be upset about something that doesn't exist, a reality that never took form. You know, and that's part of growing up, isn't it? Thinking this has happened now. What do we do going forwards?
Yeah, I think that's so that what you talked about there in terms of, you know, wishing it was different kind of thing. That was one of the things that really got me with what I went through, because I ended up spending a lot of time thinking about one area where I wish something had been different. And it doesn't matter how much you tell yourself you can't change it. You play it over and over and over and over again. So rumination was one of the things that sort of got me into a bit of a bad way. But you've got to get to the point where you're able to step back from that situation and understand that you can't change it, because I think it's it can drag you down, can't it?
And we keep going over stuff in our head, and that's a form of PTSD, and you're going over, 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 and then you catastrophize everything, but it's happened.
Doesn't change the now or the future, does it?
No.
What do you got riding a rocking horse? You can do it all night, but you're not going nowhere. You know what I mean? Yeah. But do you want to tell us a bit about your life? How you've got to you now?
Blimey, that we'd only got an hour. well, how we've got to here, I suppose, is I used to be a lawyer at a law firm based in the Black Country. You guys did a bit of work with them. Got introduced to you guys, and we had a conversation about what you were doing. And I thought, I mean, I can't remember how far through my journey in terms of my own mental wellness I was at that stage, but what you were doing in terms of giving people the ability to speak in an environment they wouldn't necessarily have access to, I thought was phenomenal. Because I was a partner in a law firm, had a particular situation, which we can talk more about as we go, and I had instant access to help. So as soon as I got to the point where I realised there was something wrong, and that came through various different people telling me I needed to go and get help. But as soon as I wanted it, I phoned an insurer. The insurer then put me in front of a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist then put me in front of somebody else, and then I got to a therapist. And over a period of time, that unlocked a lot of stuff. Very difficult process, took a long, long time, and I ended up getting better. But some of the things you guys are doing in terms of who you reach out to don't necessarily have a private medical insurance policy. And if they go through the NHS, it's a crapshoot as to whether they get to the right person. And some of the therapies that the NHS have got aren't necessarily suitable for everyone. And so I was just blown away by the fact that people like you guys are out there dishing it out to people who don't necessarily get the opportunity to have access to help otherwise. So
as you said, you've seen it from when you've gone down the private route. Some people have, we had someone on here, I can't remember who it was, but they had all the money at the hands, and they could have gone private. But it took them years and years and years to admit they got a problem. We talked about this before. I remember a couple of years ago, and I was saying, Lee, because I've known him for a long time, saying, you're starting to spiral again. Not spiral, but I could see. And all of a sudden, you phoned up, didn't you? And you said, you could see it, Kev, from a mate looking in.
Mm.
It wasn't, oh, God, look, he's falling apart. I went, look, get yourself back on track then. But often we go, who are you to tell me? And I'm all right. And our all right is I'm sculling the beers,
yeah,
or I'm working, or but I'm all I'm doing is smoking mirrors.
But it's a really so falling. I said earlier on, having a nervous breakdown for me wasn't some moment where a light switched on or off and I fell to the floor with my arms in the air wailing. Yeah. It happened over a very, very long period of time, really gradually, so you don't notice it. It was literally, I can remember the day and time when I actually got to the point where I thought, I need to do something about it. It's so gradual that you're no worse in your own head on Monday than you are on Sunday, and certainly going to be no worse on Tuesday. So if you don't have that frame of reference to actually take touch points, it does take somebody else external to you to say, like you said to Lee, you might be spiraling. A partner at work said to me, if what we just talked about downstairs resonated with you, you need to sort yourself out. So we had Dudley Mind come in to give a talk to my law firm. I was however many years into whatever process I was in. And everyone was in the atrium where you know where you come in sitting in our law firm, where I used to be. And this guy from Dudley Mind said that the sad reality is that one in four of you at the moment is experiencing poor mental health. Mm. And the likelihood is that 50% of you over the next 12 months will suffer a similar issue. And I sat there and I looked around and I went, you poor people, fucking hell, how are you going to cope with that? Mm. That's really, 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 oh, Christ, it's me.
Yeah.
And then thought, oh, right, she's actually directly addressing me. And I went back upstairs and sat in my office, and one of the guys who'd organised it looked at me and went, that's resonated with you, hasn't it? And I was like, I didn't want to speak. Mm. It really, really got me. And he said... He said, right, to the extent it has, you need to go and sort yourself out. So I went through the process of, I went to the GP and I sat with the GP and she said, right, how can I help you? And I sat there in my head, I went, tell her you got a cold, tell her you got a sore throat, tell her you sprained your ankle, tell her you got COVID, tell her anything.
Yeah.
Don't tell her that. So anyway, I sort of plucked up the courage and told her. And I think once you get to the point of crossing that point of accepting you need help, it does take a lot of courage to actually get it.
Yeah.
So the person you said who's got access to all the money and the insurance and everything else, you've still got to take that step.
Yeah. And that step's just scary either way, isn't
Christ,
it?
It really is. Mm. And then when I sat with this psychiatrist, bloody hell, the hardest 5 hours of my life. But she said to me at the end of it, she said, I can't help you, but I know somebody who can. And I was super fortunate that she put me in touch with a therapist who I instantly clicked with. I still see him now. Great bloke. Owe him an awful lot, which I tell him very frequently. But I know a lot of people see a therapist and they just don't get on.
Again, that's kind of the flaw with the NHS. Once you get to that stage, you're with who you're with.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because you were lucky that you found that one. We had someone come on who'd gone a bit... you've read the book, Anthony, and I can't remember his name now, it's gone. But he'd gone for about five therapists before he found the one. I thought, even just doing that, imagine that, going to one... not clicking with them, and then have to go to another one to do the same again.
The stamina.
No.
And you've got to remember that you are incredibly vulnerable at that stage. You know, you're emotionally exhausted. You're probably physically quite knackered through the whole process of actually, you know, fessing up and getting on with it. So I was super lucky to meet James. He was, we had the first couple of sessions, and it was like someone turned on a light bulb. So it was, I was very fortunate.
Because when you have hit rock bottom, when you're feeling there, it's a very frightening place, isn't it? As you said, because you feel like you've had a good hiding physically. That's how I felt, you know, when depression's got me. I feel it's knocked me about physically. I could have a belly full of anything. And then you got shame, you got guilt, you got, I'm a weakling, I'm a bum, I'm a failure. And then we were saying off air, well, what have you got to moan about? And you're thinking, blood. But how many poor buggers? That was the last throwaway saying they heard before they've gone and killed themselves.
100%. I can completely identify with that in terms of what the fuck have you got to be upset about?
Mm.
And it's like, you know, until you live between somebody's ears, you really don't know. Mm. I think that's incredibly difficult.
We said that about our celebrities, don't we? Anthony Joshua, David Beckham. Mm. Oh, I'd love to be them, all their money, playing football, punching, boxing all the time. What they got to moan about? You're going, you don't know what they're going through.
Yeah.
Look at them, just because they've got this ideal, you know, in your eyes, doing a sport for a living. You can go to McDonald's.
You can go and have a meal with
a family. You can go for a walk. You can walk the dog. You can. Their life is just constantly. And as we said about success, who are you, friend? If anyone new comes into your life, I've got to hold you like that because everyone else has used and abused me.
And the other thing is, what's success?
What is success?
So it's, you know, I mean, I've done deals in the past. So my background, I used to be a corporate lawyer. So I'd work with companies, shareholders of companies, when they came to sell them, they'd build an asset that was worth 50 million quid and then they'd sell it to some multinational. They'd all get trays with a load of money. It was never as much as the next guy at the golf club. Mm. And their Porsche was never as good as the next guy's Ferrari. Or their BMW was never as good as the guy's whatever.
Yeah.
And so we were talking about human nature is that you push on and you drive and you're ambitious and you try and you try and try. But I think the whole thing around horizon happiness, you know, when this happens, I'll be happy. When this happens, I'll be happy. And when we get over that hill, I'll be happy. You never get over that hill.
Mm.
So it doesn't matter whether you've got money in the bank, whether you've got a beautiful car, whether you've got whatever. If you don't work out how to be happy in what you've got now, you ain't going to be happy over there because you never get there. So it's like you've got to reframe what success looks like. Success for me at the moment is now. This is fantastic. I'm loving doing this.
Yeah.
Now,
do you think you can have the same amount of success? Do you think you can keep pushing forward, should I say, if you are happy, is in terms of development? So let's say those people are actually, he's not trying to strive for that bigger Porsche, but he's grown his company, he enjoys doing that. Do you think the same drive is there for that person than the one who he's trying to catch up with the person over there?
I think my experience on that front is when they're growing a business and they're responsible for people's mortgages, people's aspirations, their career development, the new territory they're going to win in a new country, whatever it may be, the drive to get that going is way more than turning their 10 million invested with Casanova or St James Wealth, whoever it may be, into 12 million. Because by that stage, where's the interest? Where's the drive?
I think that myself, when you look at people like Alan Sugar, or Bob Arum in the boxing, what do you think? You've earned more than enough money to probably retire 50 million times over. But there's something, you've got to be enjoying what you're doing. Now, is that a competitive thing where you're trying to be better than everyone else? Or is it just, actually, I enjoy what I'm doing. I'm turning up every day.
Or is that your identity?
Yeah. I can probably say it now. I'm not a lawyer anymore. But I used to say it in the shadows when I was a lawyer. And this is not every client before anyone gets cross and shouts at me. But a lot of the clients I've worked with in the past, and I can think of a few that I'd name, but I won't, who are genuinely sociopathic about success.
Mm-hmm.
They will do anything. And I mean, and we talked earlier on about what people will do to make money. And it's kind of, it's a drive that I don't think is very pretty. I think it's really ugly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that kind of, that's the person, that's the guy or the girl who's going to get to that golden pot at the end, having fucked everyone over to get to that point, have lost all their friends, all their mates have disappeared. Their marriage is in the pan. Their kids don't speak to them, but they've got that X pot that they wanted to get to. They get it. And that is such a hollow victory.
Well, then all they realise is all they've got is money.
And it does nothing.
Mm.
It's just a different number at the bottom of the same.
Yeah, there comes a point where you just don't need it. Like, everyone needs a certain amount to survive and thrive on. And I think it's the point where you're not stressed about money. So if you want to go on holiday, yeah, not a problem. You know, you go and do it.
I'm not sure it's ever really enough for a lot of people.
Well, my mum said, money can't make you happiness, but the lack of money can make you sad.
Yeah, that's true. That is very true.
And it's that borderline of, if I've got nothing, I will do, you know.
Yeah.
But it's not like, I have £100, have £1,000, have £100,000. And it's like, and then, like, you could have £100,000 every year. Then next year, well, come on, then.
Yeah.
You know, it's a give me, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Instead of like, well, and I think a lot about this, about, and I said to you off air, health, wealth, happiness. And it's like, but it's, what order is it in?
Yeah.
Why do I want money so I can spend more time with my family?
Mm.
Why do I want to be healthy so I can live more time doing more things with my family?
Yeah.
And then those things are making me happy, and just being with my family, all of us being healthy, makes me happy. And it's like, But if I had £1 million, what would I do? But I'd work extra. I'd work 7 days a week to get it. So I'm not seeing my family. I'm not. And then you think, well, how is that making me happy then?
I don't think you've got to remember the crucial time of seeing your family, especially yeah. Jasmine age, Mark Allah's age, and, yeah. and well, the other two as well, is now.
Yeah.
Because like you said, you miss 7 years. I missed a lot yeah, of my yeah. son's life.
Yeah. And, first, and I mean, Mary's 17 now, but when she was born, I was working my way up the ladder. And like I said to you earlier on, I was at the house before she woke up and back way after she'd gone to bed for forever. Mm. If I got to see her at weekends, that was as much as it was, which is sad to say, really. And I think loads of people say to you, in the blink of an eye, they'll be off and married, and you think, yeah, whatever.
Mm.
And here we are, she's 17 learning to drive, and
it's been a blink of an eye.
Absolutely right.
Mm.
But whether you're a lawyer, a boxing coach, or running pubs, we do that, don't we, as blokes? And as moms, you know, because moms, they say, we work so hard to provide, or we're doing this. And I often think about something like Muhammad Ali, the greatest of all time, Michael Jordan, the greatest basketball of all time. But was he the greatest dad of all time?
I think it's quite hard being a bloke.
It is.
Because I think the expectation on you, that you create yourself more often than not, but by Western society and everything else, I think no one really knows what success looks like as a bloke. That's why bloke sells his business for £5 million, and in 2 years' time he's working again because he thinks he's got to provide more. Or you always feel like you're underachieving, irrespective of what you've got or what you've done or what you've achieved. I think you're always thinking, is there something else I should be doing? Should I be doing more? And I think that's really difficult. It's when do you find contentment? When do you find, like, rest? I don't know whether you do.
I'm glad as I get older, I think I find it more now than I did as I was younger, definitely. Find contentment in things.
Do you think there's a difference? And I always think this about myself. There's a difference between content and being comfortable. I think when you're comfortable, you're in a bit of a rut. You stick in a job just because, well, I might not like the next job, or I'm not happy with my partner. But we're comfortable, and it's content of, you know what, I've got enough. And I think they're saying the same, but they're very different.
I think they are very, very different. I think the words you use there, enough, is really, really important. And I think recognising what enough is really hard for a lot of people. Like I say, the guy who sells his board, the girl who sells her business for £5 million, and in 2 years' time she's working again. Because that £5 million isn't as much as her mate down the road got selling her whatever for £8 million. And it's not all about money, is it? It's about status and power and position, and money obviously comes into it. But at what point you work out that you can just be, I think is really hard for people. I think it's really hard.
Being, yeah. And that's individual for all of us, isn't it? But what is enough? And you think to yourself, your car gets you from A to B. It can go 200 miles an hour, but the speed limit's only 50. You know what I mean? And you get all this, and you think, well, I've got £100 million, but when are you ever going to spend it?
I bought my dream car in the middle of, what is it in the middle of? So go back to what happened with me for a sec. So I was out of the law, doing some work in a company, went back to a law firm I've been working for in the past, and something bad happened. We'll just leave it at that. And the something bad I was sat in the middle of for a variety of different reasons, and blamed myself for that, 100% blamed myself for that. But in the middle of that, I'd bought my dream car, as was then, and spent 18 months maybe driving it around thinking, not all the time, but on occasion when I wasn't in the greatest frame of mind, which lamppost do I drive into next? Dream car. Always wanted one, bought it. So got to the point where I'd got amassed the wealth to be able to buy that car. And because of how I'd allowed my brain to get and how I'd allowed myself to be, that's what I wanted to do with it. So it doesn't matter whether you've got all the money in the world or all the power in the world or whatever it may be. Depression, anxiety, stress, they don't give a shit how much you got in the bank. They just don't. So I think it's more important to understand, and like we were talking about education around mental health earlier on. I think had I known what I knew within 6 months of having therapy, I'm pretty confident I wouldn't have got into the position I got into.
And I think this stuff with therapy, It's you at that point could listen to the information you received. Sometimes when we're, it's like when your dad saying, "Don't do that, son. You'll get your heart broke," or "Don't do that, you'll get beat up."
You have to learn. Yeah.
And you have to be there to find it out. And that person you are at that time is the right person to hear it. Like, I have so many people going, "I wish I'd come boxing 10 years ago." When, maybe it wasn't right for you 10 years ago. Maybe you have to go on.
I agree, but I think from my perspective, because I spent a Christ knows how much time thinking about it, in my environment in professional services, as a 25-year-old bloke, you were encouraged to work till midnight every night. You were told the only way to get at the greasy pot is to work that hard, to take on more, to do more, to work harder, take on more responsibility, to get promoted, get to the next rung on the ladder. And I think the sad thing about it is, you mentioned PTSD earlier on. They did a survey of C-suite executives of NASDAQ companies in the States, and over 33% of them were suffering with PTSD, which is just extended exposure to unrealistic levels of stress. So, you know, PTSD is something we associate with warfare, isn't it? But we're talking about people who just work in an office suffering from PTSD because of the stress they're put under. So when I was a youngster and I was going through that really hard yard, the cannon fodder kind of work, the people above me should have been potentially saying, not me per se, but the group of people I was working with, who should have been saying, "Is that right? They're working till 2 o'clock in the morning and they haven't been home for 2 days," or whatever it may be. They were happy for you to do that because it just meant they made more money.
Morning, yeah.
So if you got into that frame of mind, by the time I then got to become somebody who was in charge of teams and responsible for people, I was probably really fucking horrible because my default position was, you work harder so I don't have to, almost. And so I think it's, you say, would I have listened at the time? I think if I'd been caught early enough and not conditioned to be that foot soldier, that go-getter's a shitty word, but the person will do anything to get a deal done. You know, if I'd been told earlier on that there's probably an easier way of doing it, I might not have been quite so hard. And I think everyone in my industry is pretty tough like that. They all sort of expect to go the extra mile, which...
But it's nice when you've been there yourself, then you can reflect on your own and you try and make the next generation better, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, you're thinking, well, look, I've been where you are now. You haven't got to put yourself on the cross. You haven't got to work until 2 o'clock in the morning. Once you've finished, go home.
But the sad reality is, Kev, if that's their goal, they'll probably still have to do that, don't they?
I don't work in the law anymore, but when I was and what I'm doing now, I'm really clear with people about boundaries. Because I think it's it is incumbent on you. If you've seen the impact of what happens if you're allowed to just run in that environment where it's more, harder, faster. I didn't burn out. I just got to the end where I got to a point where I did burn out, but I got to a point where I built up such a degree of resilience to the stress and the anxiety and everything else that I could just carry on through it. And the ultimate effect of that was a proper breakdown rather than just having a bit of, some tiredness or, you know, needing some time down or downtime, sorry. I'm really clear about boundaries with people now. I don't expect any more out of them than I'd give myself. And now I do not do that. I don't work till midnight.
We see people on your holiday, no matter where you are, and we've got the holiday, we've paid for the holiday, we're all on holiday. And then you see them on the laptop at the pool and you're thinking, this is your holiday. This is where you're supposed to be. Go and play with a baby in the pool.
Yeah.
Go and have a margarita. Go and do whatever you want.
It's hard. I think it is hard. I think there is an expectation.
I think at the point as well, it's not just expectation. It's you. It's what you do. You know.
And it's what you think of yourself as well.
Yeah, that's it. That's it.
I need to be on the laptop now by the pool, because if I'm not, what's going to happen to the business? I know what'll happen. Nothing.
That's it. You'll be fine.
But don't you think when we were kids, if you were lucky enough, you had a house phone and people couldn't phone up after 8 o'clock because that was your family time?
Yeah.
But nowadays we've got our devices and your phone will ping or you have an email at 2 o'clock in the morning going, "Oh, I better check on it." And you're thinking, going to bend yourself, sod.
I have to say, I think, I mean, I spent my entire junior career on my mobile phone, and it was great for me at the time because it was, I'm old now, so it was a fairly revolutionary piece of technology in terms of what you could do with it and how it opened up communication. But it also caused so many problems. I mean, that 24/7 on kind of environment, your brain's just not geared up for it.
Well, I have a work phone and a personal phone now, and I'll turn my work phone off.
So that was the one of the first things my therapist said to me when we talked a lot about how I was working and what was going on. He said, get another phone.
Mm.
And exactly the same thing, 6 o'clock on a night, I checked the work phone in the drawer.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
I don't take my phone upstairs. When I'm in bed, I leave it downstairs. And when I'm on holiday, I leave my phone at home because I think I love just being with my girls and being in the moment. You know, if I'm on holiday,
love watching your wife on a phone.
She's had it. But I always think, like, if we're on holiday, if my house burns down, even if I get the next plane,
you ain't going to put it out.
Yeah. So that's
true.
And as I see it, God forbid someone's passed away, if they died, I ain't going to, you know, I'm not going to, you're back alive.
Yeah.
What it will be. We'll sort it out. But me, my wife, my daughter are together.
I think they've got a place, but they've clearly got a place, obviously. But we've become so reliant on that instant communication thing now. You know, that whole, my daughter said the other day, they've left me unread, which means that the message has been delivered, but they haven't read it yet. Yeah. I'm like, maybe they haven't read it. Maybe they're doing something. Like, just rude days.
Well, Osama, my boxer, who's boxing for England, hopefully on GB soon. He's just gone over to India, traveled 10 hours on the plane, 10 hours on the coach. And he said he made him laugh, Kev. So we got there, been traveling all day. We're in India, it's so hot. And he went to John Water. He went, no, Wi-Fi. And he said, well, don't you want water and food? He goes, no, just get the Wi-Fi. And I'm thinking, but that's a generational thing.
But it's it. I mean, there's no going back from that now.
No,
there's absolutely no going back from it. But, yeah, I do think that sort of constant communication thing's got a lot to answer for in terms of how people's heads are.
But so what I want to touch on as well, because like we've said, the pressure of ourselves, the pressures of keeping up with the Joneses or keeping up with the Kardashians, but it's like keeping up with our expectation of our families, and our families are often doing it for the right reasons, aren't they? They want our children to do better than we did, and we want them to reach their full potential. But it can often come at the price of their happiness, can't it? And you touched on something earlier. It's how you are as a dad, but how you felt like you had to do this to keep up with like your siblings.
So I'm the youngest of four, and my elder sisters and my elder brother are all extremely bright people, and obviously, as the gene pool sort of shallowed as they got towards me, it didn't quite work.
Run
out
to the same. Litter.
And I'm just not as academically bright as those guys. And there's no shame there. It just is what it is. But in order to keep up with their academic prowess, I had to work really, really hard. And that's fine. I didn't mind that. But I think what it did do, my mum hates me talking about this, so I do apologise, mum, if you ever see this. What it did mean is that I overachieved by working hard and being cocky and, you know, trying harder than potentially my intellect suggested I should. And so I ended up in a situation where I was doing a job that A, I didn't enjoy because I wasn't good enough at it, and B, in order to it's like the fake it till you make it thing, isn't it? You've got to keep going, so you don't get found out. And all of a sudden, you find yourself over-promoted into a job you're not good enough at because an expectation was set when you were 11.
Mm.
And then you go, what the fuck am I doing this for?
Mm.
You know, and if you conflate that with the situation I had at work, which was, like I say, we had something go on where I was at the middle of it for a significant period of time, you sort of think. And the reason I quit the law to go and do other bits and pieces is I don't want to get to, didn't want to, and still don't want to get to the end of my career and go, is that it?
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think that's the right thing. You know, that there are, you know, we're not in a position where I can just take risk after risk after risk. We're just not. You know, my kids are still young, and hopefully they're going to go to university and all that sort of stuff. So we've got to earn money. But I didn't want the pressure of being a partner in a law firm, which is obviously well paid, to be the thing that kept me in the job if I wasn't enjoying it. So, but I would have, so my lad, I don't know what he'll do. I don't think he necessarily wants to be a brain surgeon, fortunately. But whatever he wants to do, or whatever any of them want to do, I'm happy with that. I think it's a far better thing to be doing something you're going to enjoy every day than doing something you think you're going to make some money
at. I think you've set a good example as well of going, well, actually, I don't enjoy it, so I'm not going to do it. Relevant of whether it's a lot of money or not.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot of pressure on a 16, 17-year-old, 20-year-old person to go, here's your career, you know, you're set for life, go and do it. Actually, it's not the case.
They keep saying, but I don't know, Mary, who's 17, says, I don't know what degree to do, because I don't know what I want to do.
And you shouldn't know, should you, really?
I'm like, why would you know?
Yeah, you're not experienced in any. If you'd have gone and done 10 years of chefing and 10 years of doing this, and then you go, actually, I like that one there. So I know on it.
Do you want to hear the utter fucking stupidity of why I became a lawyer?
Yeah, cool.
16 years old, me and my best mate watched an episode of LA Law, and they sat in an office overlooking LA. Eating croissant, drinking coffee, and me and my best mate said, that was good.
Yeah. You ended up in the Black Country. Yeah.
He's in London now. We both became lawyers, and how ridiculous is that? There was no thought to it at all. I mean, Christ, somebody should have said to us at some point, you two. Clever enough to do it.
Become a baker, at least you'll have as many questions as you want.
Bread or cheers.
Yeah, I think we've both had... We've both had our sort of difficult brushes with our careers as a result of just some bad decision or not, I don't know. But yeah.
But life's for living, isn't it? Life's for learning. And this is what I want to say to the young people downstairs at the club or people who listen to this. Live life.
Mm.
And it's like when people go, I ain't going to Turkey or I ain't going there. And I go, why? Well, Maggie didn't like it or Bill didn't like it. Mm-hmm. You might.
Yeah.
Do as many stuff in life, because then you know what? Oh, I did not like boxing, or I did not like kickboxing. Mm. But at least you can say you don't like it.
Yeah.
And it's the same with therapy. You go, counseling didn't suit me. Hitting the therapy didn't suit me. But that NLP, you know, I like that. Or my good friend Emily Barney, who's doing the brain gym from up here, Spartan. Try stuff, because you never know what will help you, what you like. And if anything else, it's a bloody good story to tell, isn't it?
Mm. Well, I think I said to you earlier on, didn't I? When I first sort of, I was in a pretty bad place for a long period of time. And fortunately, when I met James and started having sessions with him, it unlocked an awful lot pretty quickly. So I think when you're pretty low, it's quite easy to bring you. The difference in you is quite marked early on, isn't it? So I was really evangelistic about therapy when I first started seeing James. Not that I'm not now. But I'd tell everyone, and I'd say, you should, why don't you just go and check it out, just see what it's about, just see whether you like it or not. They'd say, there's nothing wrong with me. And I'd say, well, A, you don't know what's wrong with you, because I didn't for a significant period of time. And I think if people were better educated about how it works and what the signs are, and being upset for a couple of days isn't depression.
No.
But working out what is really, really important, because by the time you've worked out what it is, probably...
You've been sitting in there a long time.
Long. And as we said earlier on, with the way your brain works, the longer you spend in a particular state of mind, the more you are training your brain for that to be its default. So if you spend your time highly anxious, if you worry about everything, if you care so much about everything, you worry. I said to you earlier on, my mom is classic. She's the most anxious person in the world. She's worried if she's got nothing to worry about.
Yeah.
It's just, and so if you spend your time like that, that's your default.
Yeah.
So I said to people before, you know, well, why don't you just go and have a session, see what you think? And a number of people have come back to me and said, I think it made a lot of sense. And you could see us getting to a point, I'm not saying this is the right thing, but you could see us getting to a point in the UK where it is just seen as it's just something you do.
But we do go and see the dentist. For our checkups, don't we? I'll tell you something, my back's twitching. I'm going to go and see a physio, or I'm going to go and see a dietitian, or I'm going to go and see a rheumatologist. Or
why would you wait until you're clinically depressed?
Until you're broken. Mm. And once they
get, but men do that anyway. We spoke about this before, and I did have the stats, I can't remember them now, but men do that anyway. If men will drag out going to the doctors about anything for as long as they possibly can before they actually go. It's almost like we have to get to that breaking point before you actually are better go now.
Yeah, and I think obviously there's still the big stigma there with saying I've got a problem between my ears. People still don't. I have to say, I think it's a if you do go through it, or if you have any affinity to it, I think it's a responsibility to talk about it, because the people who can't or don't want to or feel uncomfortable about it, I think it's really disarming when you say, oh, I had a breakdown in 2018, I had a big one in 2019, and this is what happened, and this is why I did, and this is how I made it better. The guy who said to me, if that conversation we've just had with Dudley Mind resonated with you, go and sort it out. He has had family history of mental unwellness. And so him just saying that to me, saying, I recognise that you need to do something about it. Mm. If he'd not said that, I might not have gone.
Mm.
I recognise she was talking to me when she said about one in four of you have got a problem. But would I have done something about it without him talking to me? I don't know. So I think you've got to talk about it. You've got to be open about it. And the whole idea of waiting until you're absolutely rock bottom before you do something about it's crazy. Especially therapist's job, Majada.
And as you said, there's realizing you need help, there's accepting you need help, and there's doing something about it.
So what have I said? Realization, courage, commitment, perspective, and knowledge. That's what you need. You've got to realize you're in trouble. You've got to have the courage to do something about it. You've got to commit to a process. There's no point in going and seeing somebody saying, didn't work, so I'm just going to go back to where I was, because you've done the hard bit. You know, you've done the hard bit. Why fall off the wagon at that point? You've got to have some perspective on it, because it's not going to change overnight, and it is you've got to accept that there is the change will come, but you've got to get to that point where you can get perspective on the problems you're trying to deal with. And the knowledge bit was the best bit for me. So I had a session with the therapist about, I can't remember how many months into it it was now. And James said, sat down, and we were still doing face-to-face, so it's pre-COVID. He said, what's wrong with you? Face like thunder. I said, I'm really fucking annoyed. And he said, well, what's wrong with you? I said, well, I've been thinking about all the stuff you told me over the past couple of months and all the things we've been through. And I said, had you told me, or had I known that stuff when I was in my 20s, early 20s, late 20s, 30s, whatever it may be, I'd have been a better friend to all my mates, 100%. I'd have been a better husband to my wife, without a doubt. I'd have been a better dad, I'd have been a better colleague, I'd have been a better boss. Had I known all this shit, none of this would have happened, and I'd have just been a better person. And he said, because I was really inflamed by the knowledge of it all, and he said, that's exactly your problem. And I was like, what do you mean that's my problem? He said, well, rather than congratulating yourself for taking action, coming and seeing me, learning about it, putting it into practice, and being a better husband, being a better dad, being a better colleague, being a better blah, blah, you'd rather beat yourself up for a load of shit you can't change from the past. And that's the truth of it.
Yeah.
So once you get to that knowledge and you do understand that it wasn't necessarily all your fault, and it wasn't just that you were stupid or ineffective or weak or lazy or whatever it may be, and that there is a set of circumstances and chemicals and all sorts of external factors that make you into that kind of person, if you can take that knowledge and pass it forward, I think that's a bit of a superpower, isn't it? So you've got to tell people about it.
In that, you just didn't know the answer.
You 100%
didn't. Everything's easy if you know the answer. But if you don't know it, then, you know what I mean? But once you do know it, it's your obligation then to share it, isn't it?
I think so.
That's a lovely way of seeing it. And that is bang on, that is. But as we were saying, I don't know if we were saying it on air or off air, enjoy the good times and deal with the bad times. And as you said, as that moment of clarity, don't be angry that you didn't know it yesterday. Just be happy you know it today and remember it tomorrow.
But I thought I was making all this progress. I'd learned all this stuff. I was putting it into practice. And I came in and I said, I was so cross. And he said, it's exactly your problem. I was like, damn it. Too bright. But it is, I think it's, and you know, I think that, I've been seeing James for I don't know how many years now, quite a long time. I think when I first started seeing him, it was pretty bad. I mean, I was not a particularly nice person to anyone else or to myself. And I think that's one of the really, really hard parts that got me quite upset when we were really getting into it. And we were talking about self-perception, and you talked earlier, I don't know if it was on air or off air, about shame. And the whole shame around this situation that happened at work, where I was sort of involved in it, was it my fault? Did people blame me? Should I, you know, there was a point in time where I wouldn't even go into various meeting rooms just in case someone was talking about me. I mean, how crackers is that, quite literally? But we talked about how you perceive yourself in these situations and how you deal with the idea of guilt, embarrassment, shame, all that sort of stuff. And he said, so how do you interact with yourself? And I was like,
very personal question.
Personal question. Hang on. I've been checking my phone, have you? we chatted about it. He said, if you spoke to any of your friends the way you speak to yourself, what'd happen? I said, I'd have no friends.
Yeah.
He said, what do you mean? Talk me through that. And I won't go through it because it's pretty nasty. Mm. But he said, so the things you call yourself, the way you consider yourself to be, how utterly disgracefully mean you are to yourself isn't sustainable. And unfortunately, that ends in somebody taking their own life, if you get it to the end of that road. And I think it's really easy when you are emotionally weak, mentally weak, feeling embattled, feeling shame, feeling guilt, to actually be pretty nasty to yourself. And I think,
it's Chinese water torture, isn't it? Telling yourself, imagine someone who's actually physically standing there telling you, you're that worthless, or you're that, or you're this, or you're that. It's just going to drag you down.
And the reality is, the only person that thinks like that is you.
Mm.
And it really upset me when we got into that. It was one of those sessions where I remember sitting in the car. Many times I sat in the car after one of the sessions with him, having to have a word with myself. But that was a really tough one. Because if you can't be nice to yourself, do you know what I mean? It's pretty bad.
But the reason why, and I say this a lot, the reason why our nightmares scare us is because we know what we're frightened of. If you're frightened of hamsters, and that's why our nightmares, you can wake up and you're petrified.
Yeah, yeah.
But we also know what upsets us. We know that horrible thing that no one can call us or say about us, but we will say it to ourselves because we know we can get a reaction off ourselves.
Yeah.
So that bad part of our mind, that mind is working against us. He says some really horrible, awful. Your kids are better off without you. You're a bum, you're this, you're this, and everyone. But you can't just go, oh, I'm not going to talk to Lee, I'm not going to talk to Aid. It's there all the time. It's there when you're trying to go to sleep.
But you can also change that, can't you? That takes a lot of work. But that's
the work that goes into it. Before the work, when you're lost in the fog of it, you can't see the end.
Trying to deal with that yourself without help, I think he's almost impossible because, like I said earlier on, it's such a gradual process. I didn't go from being a relatively happy-go-lucky, normal, happy guy to calling myself some of the worst things in the world overnight. Yeah. It took a long time, but it was nearly 7 years before everything sort of resolved. I was better. I think the thing sort of dropped in 2015. I got myself into trouble in 2017, and by 2020, I think I was already in therapy. So I had 3 years where I was pretty horrible. But in that three-year period, I didn't start off just straight into hammering myself. I was just a bit questioning whether or not could I have done this better? Should I have done that better? You know, how responsible am I for the whole kind of landscape of what's happened? By the end of it, my God, you'd have thought I'd started World War III. I was horrible.
It's death by paper cuts, isn't it? You haven't just stabbed yourself once and it's over. It's those little paper cuts. And eventually it's hard to find another place to cut yourself.
Then you wake up and...
Yeah. You have to go off Hellraiser with all the pins.
Horrible.
But once you're there, and someone said to me the other day, when you're in the fog, you're still trying to walk normal, but you notice holes everywhere. Sometimes you just got to slow it down, slide your feet, and just realising the end of the path's there. Just take your time.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? And eventually, if you've got a therapist, a loved one, who does give you that beacon of light just to focus on in the horizon. But we need that, don't we? Whatever you call it, it could be
100%. Absolutely 100%. I think I used to phrase it walking in the woods in the dark.
Yeah.
You know, I love walking in the woods in the day. I love taking the dog for a walk. I wouldn't want to walk around him in the dark. But that's kind of how my mental state differed between when I was okay and when I wasn't. Walking around the woods in the dark, scary.
Walking around the woods in the dark on your own is petrified. Like if you stay in the woods on your own, you hear a whistle. Oh, God. You're a wood cracking.
Yeah.
If you've got someone there, you go, it's just an owl.
Yeah.
It's just a tree. Yeah. But if you're sat there on your own, it's the boogeyman, it's Jack the Ripper, it's your mind, once again, fear, fight, survive, survive. If you've got someone there, just go, it's all right.
And that there's the importance of having someone right there.
Yeah. Okay.
If you've got someone there who's more petrified than you, you're going to get more petrified. It is the people around you make a big difference to your mental health.
Yeah, I agree.
And you see that, and I say it's so much with boxing. You're nervous? No, I'm fine. You sure you ain't nervous? No, I'm fine. I'd be nervous. Why would you be nervous? Yeah. I was 5 to 10 minutes ago. Piss off.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And even that's with parents and their anxiety, their nerves. And that's in the workplace. Mm. That's in the pub. That's everything, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you can feed so much on other people's feelings. And unfortunately, if you're in a dark place, and sometimes, you know, because I'm talk to everyone about everything, and sometimes, okay, because Kev, you're not in a good place now, put down your phone, bud, because you're already struggling, and there's so much sorrow in the world anyway. Get yourself right.
Mm.
And that's what we do, isn't it? You go, nah, well, you know, and you're thinking, sometimes put yourself first.
Or isn't it that thing you've got to put on an aeroplane, you've got to put your own oxygen mask on before you can help anyone else? It's true. If you're not okay, you've got no hope of helping anyone else.
And you've got to get the help. And the help can be a therapist.
Mm.
It can be called up to the gym. It could be, but you've got to find your medicine, haven't you? That's been a saying ever since we started, isn't it?
Yeah.
Find your medicine. That could be going to church. That could be going for a run. That could be going to... But often what we do is, my medicine is 10 points, a couple of bags of this, and you're thinking, that's not... you're just filling the hole
with something. Through the worst parts of when I was struggling, I definitely self-medicated with booze.
Yeah.
And it was really good for me because I listened to a podcast by, her name's Terry White. She was the editor of Time magazine, I think she was. And she said her relationship with alcohol was fantastic because it was like filling her head full of candy floss.
Yeah.
And the great thing for me is because I course dippy ruminate everything, get a problem over and over and over and over and over and over until the world's going to end.
Mm.
Couple of pints, I stop talking to myself.
Mm.
Whether it's calling myself bad names, whether it's saying everything's going to go wrong, catastrophizing, whether it's overthinking things. A couple of beers, and I'm not beating myself up anymore.
Mm.
But the problem is, a couple of beers then becomes
a lot of beers,
four beers, and then becomes six beers. And the problem for me is that it makes me incredibly anxious.
Mm.
So the next day I wake up, I never get hangover particularly, but the next day I wake up and I know that I'm anxious about everything. So I'm 10 times more exposed to the risk.
Mm.
And so I was pretty shit through going through troubles with the booze.
Well, someone once explained that to me, and it always stuck with me. It's like having a beer is like when your parents go away. It says, yeah, let's wreck the house, let's go steal it, let's get it. And next day, your parents come back and you're going, oh, no. And
it's much worse.
Freedom.
Yeah, yeah,
but then the parents are always going to come back. But then you've got the, I'm in trouble. Everybody have to find out. Everybody. And I say, you are the next day, isn't it?
Agreed. No, agreed. Agreed. It's difficult, isn't it? I think the other thing that I learned that really helped me, there are a few things. So my dog has been my mental health superhero. Without him, I don't know what I'd have done. So I think my dog is definitely a big part of my recovery. But one of the biggest things for me about getting through where I was learning what to care about and what not to care about. Because I was in a position where I couldn't get any perspective on what mattered, if that makes sense. Yeah, so I had to care about everything equally, which is just totally unsustainable.
Yeah.
So what time Tesco were coming to do the delivery was as important as whether or not a deal were completed in my head, because I couldn't get any perspective. And so one of the things we worked really hard on was caring less about everything. Now, that's a really tricky path to get down, because if you do it right, you can care about nothing, which is brilliant. I had no responsibility and didn't care about anything. But I think there's definitely a happier place for me to be as an individual than being so absolutely fucking nailed on invested in every outcome. Because you can't influence every outcome, because guess what? You ain't that important. And no matter how big you think you are in the world, you're not. So caring less about some of the outcomes is really important that you can't influence. And also, caring less about outcomes and finding out that they go okay anyway is a real revelation. You didn't have to do it all. Somebody else did part of it, or it worked itself out.
Mm.
I think that was a really big thing for me about not having to hold on to everything like with a vice-like grip on everything. And that, once you get to the point of understanding that, A, you caring doesn't really make that much of a difference, and B, the outcome's the outcome anyway, it was quite liberating for me.
As you said, caring about the right things.
Yeah.
And there's a lovely thing I saw on the internet, I don't know, professor, And it's a great thing. I shared it quite on Facebook. And he gets a jar and he gets golf balls. And he's like, can I fit anything else in there? He goes, no, sir. And he puts the grapple in. He goes, can you fit anything else in? He goes, no, sir. Then he pours some sand in. Then he pours a beer in. He goes, but I had to put things in order. Your golf balls, are your family, or your whatever, the gravels, I don't know, the card, the sand is work. But you try and put the sand in first, then you can't get the gravel in. You definitely got the bit prioritizing the things that actually do matter.
Absolutely.
And the foremost thing is your family.
Yeah.
Your health, your well-being. And then it's, all right, the bills, they've got to come next.
But again, it's going back to that. I think it's hard being a bloke in 2024 because there's so much pressure on you to provide for your family and provide more for your family, do more and go on the holiday and buy the car and blah, 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 that sometimes you are pouring the beer in before the sand.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, it's only when you sort of have the chance to step back and look at it and go, I'm making a mess here.
Yeah.
And we know we're not really good at that either.
No.
Admitting we're making mistakes. So.
But, and I say this quite often, I'm not the cleverest man in the world, far from it. But one thing I'm sure of, every man who's ever walked on the earth or ever will walk on the earth has either made a mistake or will make a mistake. 100%. And that's one thing I do know. But we think, I've dropped a bollock.
Mm.
Join the club.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's only a mistake if I keep repeating it over and over. It's going, all right then, hands up.
Yeah.
Either I'm sorry. I didn't know any better. I knew better. I chose badly, but I won't repeat it.
Yeah, 100% agree.
And that's life, isn't
it? Yeah, yeah. It is all about how you react to setback, isn't it? And I think the difficulty I had with mine was I reacted really badly. And by the time I'd worked out I'd reacted badly, it was probably a little bit too late because I'd sort of got ingrained behaviours about what I thought about situations, what I thought about my value, et cetera, et cetera. And so if your foundations are shaky when you start laying stuff on top of it, it all just crashes down. So, it's hard, but I think you've got to spend more time taking stock and getting perspective than we do. I think we just race through life at a million miles an hour and expect it all to be okay. And
it's like what you were saying earlier about stuff like, it's all about the destination, all about the destination, but it's someone who enjoys walking will walk farther. So if you can enjoy the journey, you're going to get somewhere better.
Mm.
You know what I mean? If you just want to be that zillionaire, you know what I mean? You get to be in a zillionaire, but what's else to go? But if you're just enjoying doing what you're doing, but it's making you a bob or two.
There's always another destination, isn't
there?
So you do have to enjoy.
So you're enjoying plodding along, on your merry way.
Yeah, yeah. No, I totally agree.
But if you could say to someone, and you've got to be a kid, and you've got to be your younger self, but someone who's getting into law or business.
Don't do it. It's a trap. Go on, sorry.
What would you, who wants to, let's call it be successful in the, you know what I mean? What would you tell them? What would you advise them? Or
that presupposes I know. I have no idea. I think from a professional services perspective, I had a conversation with a lawyer a little while ago who came to me and said, I want you to help me with my application to get promotion and do this, that, and the other, blah, blah, blah. Not for the firm I was working at, somebody I know in Birmingham. And we sat down and had a chat and we were talking for about an hour. And I said to her after about an hour, I said, do you know why you want the promotion? And they said, well, I want more money. I want this, that, and the other. Blah, 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 blah. I said, but is the more money worth the more stress, the more responsibility, the more expectation, the more client demands, the more compliance, the more regulation, everything else that comes with it? And if you actually worked out what the more money actually is once you paid your tax and you blah, blah, blah. We went through the whole process and I actually saw that person about 2 or 3 weeks ago and they found a level in their career, which is not where they were aiming for when we were talking about it a few years ago. It's a few rungs further down the ladder, but they're happy.
Yeah.
And I think what I'd say about anyone who wants to be successful, whatever that means, because I don't know, is it's not reaching that final destination. It's not becoming a zillionaire. It's not, for me anyway, and I think you've got to define that yourself, haven't you? But it's going back to what you said earlier, it's being happy. And no job is going to make you happy every day of the week because it's a job. You're not paid to have fun, you're paid to work.
I think sometimes as well, you don't stop and realise whether you're happy or not.
Agreed.
Because you're too busy trying to reach further. Yeah. You know, stop. Am I happy? Do I enjoy doing this job? Yeah, I do. So why am I looking for more?
But like promotion? When I was talking to this girl about her promotion application and we went through it all and I said, and you have to write down why you want the job and why you think you'd be good at it and what you'd do to achieve all the sort of dreams this new role promises. We went through it all. I said, are you going to do that? Don't know. Well, can you do that? I could learn. Well, do you want to do that? Oh, no, I don't want to do that. So when we deconstructed the whole application, she put, it's all bullshit. Now, I'm sure she's a bright person. I'm sure she could do all that if she wanted to. But for what? You know, now she's got two little kids. She works a three, four day week, whatever it may be, works at remote, et cetera, et cetera. And I think she, nothing to do with me, she made the decision, but I would imagine she's far happier now than she would have been had she got that promotion. And I'm probably overlaying my own story there on it that I overpromoted myself to get to where I got to and worked out it was no fun. But I think anyone going into any job or anything in life, work out what's going to make you happy before you think what success is, because I don't think they're the same thing.
And that is it, success, happiness. We often think if I get the one, the other one's guaranteed. And not always. But it's at what point do I cross my moral compass? At what point would I do anything for it? And thinking, where do I lose myself? When do I have to define myself? Because I'm successful, am I a good husband? Am I a good man? Am I a good father? Am I a good...
I think it comes at a cost. I think if you were defining success purely by what you got in the bank or what assets you got around you, the size of your house, whatever it may be, the likelihood is you haven't been a great dad. You haven't been a great husband. You probably haven't been a great boss, to be honest with you. I think I said to you off air earlier on, one of the clients I worked with years and years and years ago said, you know, you shouldn't envy anyone's wealth until you know what they've had to do to get it. Because a lot of people have to do, I'm not saying they're criminals or they're you know, people are better than an iron bar, but they might have had to work, you know, a 800 whatever hour week for the last 10 years and not seeing their family or whatever the sacrifices might be. And I'm not sure they're worth it.
How many football matches or how many plays or how many...
And when... I never saw any of that.
Yeah.
Never saw any of that.
And it's something... Like me, I being a visually impaired dad, and I remember saying to one of my lads, I feel terrible, you know, because I won't be able to see my daughter at the plays or what. And he went, but you'll be there though, won't you, Kev?
Yeah, yeah.
And I went, what do you mean? He goes, my dad never come to watch me box, you know, Kev. And I box over many bouts. He went, you were there for every one of them. He goes, sometimes I knew... You couldn't see me because you were at the back of the room, but I knew Kev Dillon was there at my... And he goes, your daughter will be like that.
Probably drunk.
I'll never fight myself.
But I was there.
But I was there.
That's a huge point, isn't it? You know, I think you should define what you want out of it before you start, really.
And measure that. And maybe that's a little plan, because we said the 5-year plan. I want to be here, I want this. And just think, well, who do you want to be in 5 years? And that's a very odd question to ask yourself, isn't it? Because it's like, you know, and I've found that in COVID. Hi, my name's Kevin and I teach boxing. But when you took away people's jobs, it was very odd. Then it's like, well, it's not like, hi, I'm kind, I can be a bit moody. Or hey, who are you? Not what your job is.
Yeah.
Not what your stature is. Not how much you can bench press. Not how much you can afford. Not how much, it's like, who are you? Well, what's your name? And when you break that down,
that's a tough question. You're not going to ask me that now, are you?
Well, it's for everyone to think.
You walked in telling us you're moody and miserable. We know who you are.
When you break that down,
That's
a very odd question, isn't it? I'm generous, but to any Tom, Dick and Harry, or to be Blue Matter, or I'm angry, to those who get you angry, or are you just angry at you? And it's breaking it down and going, wow. Reflecting on yourself in your warts and all. These are my good traits, these are my bad traits. These are some that may have been passed down to me. These are ones I've created myself. And just go, all right then, these are my bad traits, but which ones am I willing to change?
I wonder how many people have actually go through that introspection. And that, 'cause I think that's a really interesting exercise for everyone to do. That'd be really tough.
Mm. But life is tough. Mm. And if we don't do tough things, then we don't become tough people.
Mm.
And often we shy away from the tough questions and the tough tasks, don't we? Because we want a quick solution. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, very true.
But maybe this is, you know, a bit of homework for everybody.
Mm.
But I thank you ever so much, brother, for coming on. Good luck in everything that you do. But I'm going to ask you, as we ask everybody, have you got any quotes or sayings that have helped you get through life?
I think the one we talked about earlier on, one of my mates always talks about horizon happiness. And I think if you're always looking over the bridge for the next bit of life that's going to bring you some joy, you're missing out on the journey.
Well, guys, thank you for listening. We're back same time next week with our good friend, Boggy from Scotland. Heroine to Hero?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's brought out a new book, but he'll be telling us all about it next week. Coming all the way from sunny Glasgow, so we're going to go through Skype. So, touch wood, the internet's on our side. So, guys, until we see each other next time, I want you all to take care of yourselves and each other. Ta-ra a bit.
Listen. And that's a wrap for another show. But if there are any comments or messages that you would like us to read out for our next podcast, please be in touch. There are also lots of different organisations at the bottom of this page, and hopefully they can help you or someone you care about. Please share this to spread the word. Until we talk next time, ta-ra a bit.
Listen.